This is WNUT Talk on the WNUT Radio Network. This is WNUT Talk. I am Brandon, aka Stoney. It depends on the day. It's kind of like Janet Jackson, Miss Jackson, if you're nasty. This is WNUT Talk. This is a show where I and probably other people in the future, I'm sure that the Great Fish Niz will join me on WNUT Talk at some point, and who knows, may show up here. But anyway, the point is, here we discuss topics that we kind of want to deep dive into, or things that fascinate us, or things that we want to examine or explore or research. We want to research things and talk about them, bring them to you, expose you to stories and songs and movies and music and who knows what the fuck that maybe you haven't been exposed to before. It's just a cool concept. This is our third episode. It's still a fledgling show. Hey, we don't know, man. This thing may change the world someday. Right now, so far, all I've ranted about is physical media and record stores and the time that Prince turned into a symbol. This is only our third show in WNUT Talk. It is, you know, basically just, I look, talk radio is huge, man. If you're an angry dude behind a microphone, you instantly get millions of viewers today. So I figured, hey, why not take my turn? I'm going to get behind a microphone, I'm going to get pissed off, and then the millions of, listeners will follow. Millions of listeners will follow. Welcome to WNUT Talk. Today, I'm not talking about record stores or physical media. I'm not talking about Prince. I'm not even talking about a specific musician at all. Really, today is going to kind of be a hot hodgepodge. I'm doing a mixtape, if you will. I'm going to talk about several different musicians, several different songs. Today is going to be kind of like a look at some of the unlikeliest songs to ever hit the Billboard charts, some of the unlikeliest songs to ever become popular or to get, you know, airplay or chart success or MTV backing, however you want to categorize it. I don't know what the hell the title of this episode is going to be, you know, how I'll boil it down into a title yet, but some of these are novelty songs. Some of these are not. Some of these are just songs that you would think, why would that hit at that particular time? If it fits that kind of mold, that is what I'm talking about today. And I think this is going to be a fun one, you know. I kind of had the idea to focus on one of these songs for a WNUT Talk, but then I kind of got to thinking about it, and I was like, well, these are shaken down to be anywhere between like 30 minutes and 45 minutes. I probably would overkill discussion on this song in that time. I probably could do it easily, but I don't know that I'd want to spend 30 to 45. Hey, who knows? Maybe one of you guys would be like, hey, that particular song fascinated me. Talk about that more. And then I can do that. I can expand that out into a full episode. But right now I'm thinking, especially the one I was going to focus on, and I will let you know which one that is as we go on here. Not today. Maybe at some point when I master this format a little better and WNUT Talk is just something I can do in my sleep, that might be the time to do that. Right now I'm thinking, hey, kind of a greatest hits compilation of songs that were very unlikely to have massive chart success at the time would be the best way to go. So that is what we're going to do today. And I will start us off with a guy who came out of Europe and took America by storm in the mid-80s. And he was a new wave artist. He was a rock singer, a rapper, and a pop artist. I'm talking about the late, great, and immortal Falco, who had a hit in 1986 with a song called Rock Me Amadeus. If you haven't heard Rock Me Amadeus, and listen, I highly encourage people to, however you like to listen to this type of content. Now, if you're listening to me on Live 365, which is, it's streaming, but you can't pause it. It's live, like radio would be. So you can't like pause this show if you're listening on Live 365 and then go check out songs. But if you're listening on any of the podcast networks where I eventually upload these episodes, if you're listening on YouTube, something like that, I encourage you to check these songs out as we go along. It'll help you understand what I'm doing here, kind of how I'm talking about these songs. I don't like to play music on WNUT Talk because then when I upload it as a podcast, that stuff can get flagged, you know? So I leave music out of this show other than our royalty-free theme music that we have, which does not ding any of those copyright, red flag services. But So go check out Rock Me Amadeus if you're not familiar with it right now. It's one of the catchiest songs I think has probably ever been constructed in a lab in some studio somewhere in the world. But the Falco brought that song over here when his third album, Falco 3, was released in October of 1985. The track Rock Me Amadeus was actually inspired by the movie Amadeus, starring Tom Hulce and F. Murray Abraham. It had stormed not only the Academy Awards, but BAFTA, Golden Globes, all that stuff. The movie took dozens and dozens of awards, including the Oscar for Best Picture, and I believe the Oscar for Best Director as well. But a huge movie, and so Falco sees that and goes, you know what I should do? I should make a German new wave pop slash hip hop song about this composer from the 18th century. It'll be huge. Why not? So he does. And Rock Me Amadeus was so huge, in fact, it's the only German language song that's ever hit number one on the Billboard Hot 100. 99 Luftballons had hit number two in March of 84, but this one came along a couple years later and took the number one spot. And to date, it's the only German language song that's ever done that. There was a US remix called the Salieri version, Salieri being the composer who was kind of positioned to be Mozart's arch rival or nemesis or whatever in the film. All the Salieri version did was add a voiceover that detailed key moments in Mozart's life. It did not translate the lyrics from German into English. So there you have that. That's really the only difference when that track hopped the Atlantic Ocean and came over here that we got on our version. So it hit number one in America on March 29th, 1986. That's 2 years to the date since 99 Luftballons failed to do that. And it stayed there for 3 weeks. And as I said, it blends synth pop. You got some hip hop in there. You got German new wave. It is definitely one of the most unique songs I've ever heard. And I tell you again, very, very catchy. It is infectious. Even if you don't understand what in the fuck Falco is rapping about or singing about, you don't have to. Because music, this is a great example of how music is a universal language, of how music is something that transcends all of that. There's meaning in what you're hearing beyond the words that the artist is speaking or singing. And I love it. There's really not more stuff out there like it. If you like this and you go, man, I got to hear more like this, I don't know where to send you. And the thing I like to imagine when I listen to this song today is what the hell made this song hit so hard in America at that time. I have no idea. I mean, we've talked on WNUT, the Great Fish Niz, and I discussed Europe versus America in who kind of innovates and what sounds we trade back and forth across the ocean and how we sort of, you know, cross-pollinate music types and that kind of thing. And this is a good example of how there wasn't really something going on at that time that sounded quite like this. I think probably the closest thing we could find would be Blondie's Rapture, because that did have elements of rock, rap, and new wave, in the mid-80s at a time when, actually, that was happening in the early 80s. Rapture came out in like 81. But yeah, that would be about the closest thing I think you could find to Falco's Rock Me Amadeus. It's not like when, you know, Korn or Limp Bizkit got big in the 90s, and then all of this rap rock came along, this like rap nu metal kind of thing. You know, there were tons of bands like that. Falco didn't kick that off for what he did in the mid 80s, and I wish he had. That would have been an amazing genre to dive into. But alas, it's just Rock Me Amadeus. You got Rock Me Amadeus, and really, do you need more? It's an amazing track. Check it out. Again, proof that music itself is a universal language, because we sure didn't know what in the hell he was talking about. Now, speaking of songs where we didn't know what in the hell they were talking about, this time, we understood him perfectly. This guy's speaking plain English, and I still couldn't tell you where any of this crap came from. There was a song that just appeared on radio probably towards the tail end of 1990 that I remember hearing on the way to school one morning, played on WBBQ, which was kind of the top 40 hit station in Augusta at that time. I mean, they still exist, but they're basically an automated shell of their former self. And I think they play adult contemporary. Who the fuck knows? Anyway, I hear this song, which is kind of describing this really surreal scenario. This guy's talking about walking on a beach, and he's giving all this kind of obsessive attention to details, like his shoes squeaking. He's describing people speaking to him in foreign languages that don't make sense. He's talking about people who have these deformities that I'll get into in just a moment that are so, it sounded nightmarish to hear it at that age. Like, if you haven't heard this song, the only way that I could really probably get you to replicate this, at not being 10 or 11 or whatever I was at the time, would be to just listen to it late at night in a dark ass room with no light coming from anywhere, and just see what kind of effect it has on you. It's unnerving. It's a track called "This Is Ponderous," and it's by a group called Too New, the number 2 and the letters NU. Too New, who had not really formed as a band when this song was getting airplay. And that's apparently actually kind of how they got their name. One of the radio DJs who introduced this song, which was just sent out with a title and no artist attached to it, said that it was from a band too new to even have a name. So then the group called themselves that. So what had happened was, at some point in the late 80s, a guy named Jock Blaney, who was working as production director at KPLZ-FM in Seattle, had a very weird dream. He wrote that dream down, and then he used the concept of it in a locally produced hot tub commercial. Because, you know, he worked in media, he did some production, he did commercials, he did jingles, he did things like that. So this hot tub commercial uses elements of this very strange dream that he had. After that, he got together with a producer named Michael Neely and made a spoken word song out of it. He expanded the whole thing, told this story with it. It had rhythmically chanted choruses. And then they started airing that on KPLZ, where, again, he was an employee. And it actually became their number one requested song on that station for several weeks. So Atlantic Records notices this activity happening with this weird spoken word avant-garde kind of song. And these independent artists who don't really have any support, they don't really have any prior successes or a track record of, you know, producing things. And they go, okay, here's something we can exploit, or here's some people that we can help out with some reach and some airplay and stuff like that. So they put some resources into Too New. They signed the duo. The duo expanded, you know, they hired band members, so they're not just producing these tracks, you know, the two of them electronically and shit. They've got people to play instruments now. And they recorded a 10-song album called This Is Ponderous after this song. They you know, used this as the title track, and they actually kicked the album off with this. And the whole album, all 10 of these songs, form kind of a loose narrative around the character who's, you know, telling them in the first person. Actually, I think sometimes they go into third person. But the point is, it's kind of a concept album around this character who they name Nardo Polo. And we even learn in one of the songs that he's an unreliable narrator because that's not his real name. He's claiming to be Nardo Polo, or Nardo Polo is an alias of his or something like that. So anyway, it's an interesting piece of work. I have it. I go back and forth between really enjoying it, like in a way that I'm fascinated by it, and I kind of like to just take it in and sort of deconstruct things about it and imagine what in the hell might have inspired some of it, or kind of feeling like maybe it's not very approachable. Sometimes, you know, I listen to it and I just go, I can't get into this. Like, what am I doing? So it's a love-hate relationship I have with this album. It's definitely very unique. Again, like the Falco example, it's something I can't really point to other stuff like it. And how the hell would This Is Ponderous have become a hit song at that time in this country, really anywhere? Well, the song reached number 46 in the U.S. on the Billboard Hot 100, and it got international airplay all across the planet. So it's appealing to people out there at that time. For some reason, something about this is speaking to people. And I mentioned the kind of physical deformity of people in the song, which was sort of nightmarish. There's a part of this track where he talks about meeting a woman on a beach who talks with her eyes, and then you hear her speaking, and you hear the things this woman is saying purportedly with her eyes. Her eyes are talking these things that you're hearing in the song, which makes me envision in my head something out of either Hellraiser or the Corinthian from the Sandman comics. I cannot tell you how unnerving parts of this song are when you just take it at face value and listen to it. And this man's deadpan delivery, and kind of imagine this hellscape that he finds himself walking in. That's my interpretation. Some people may hear, you know, this dream of him walking on a beach when he's supposed to be at work. It may seem very peaceful. I don't know. It may have a different impact on you when you listen to it late at night in a dark room. I don't know. Let me know how it hits you when you try this. But the title of the song, it struck something in my brain. There's an outtake of Casey Kasem when he was recording American Top 40 in the mid-80s. And he's kind of freaking out, and he's frustrated, and he's cursing at people in the studio. And one of the things that pisses him off, he says about it, this is ponderous, man. It's fucking ponderous. And being that Jock Blaney, who wrote this song, was a guy who worked in radio, he would have heard and had access to these Casey Kasem outtakes at that time. Everybody in that business probably was pretty well aware of them. They have since circulated on the internet, and you can listen to them on YouTube and things like that. But I'm pretty sure that he named this track "This Is Ponderous" after that Casey Kasem outtake. And he starts the song by saying, "This is ponderous, man, really ponderous," replacing the word "fucking" that Casey Kasem said with "really ponderous." You know, if you're going to go to number 46 on the Billboard chart, you can't kick it off by cursing, unless you're Eminem or somebody, I guess. But anyway, that is "This Is Ponderous." If you haven't heard it, check it out. I highly recommend it. I would like to hear about your experience letting this song wash over you for the first time. And if you have heard it, but maybe it's been a while, revisit this one. Damn, it's interesting. And again, one of the most unique pieces of released music I've probably ever come across. We'll be right back after we pay some bills here at WNET Talk. Please don't go anywhere. We'll return right after this.
Hey, man, this is the Jazz Man, and you kick back listening to WNET, baby.
Full episodes at 6, noon, and 8. After dark, Saturday nights at 10. WNET.
We're back here on WNET Talk here on the Live 365 Network. If you're not listening to us on Live 365, we highly recommend that you do that. Check us out by either downloading the free Live 365 app or just search WNET on live365.com. It'll take you right to us. There you will get a streaming mix all day long, live 24 hours a day, 7 days a week of WNET hand-selected songs that we have curated and we're bringing to you. You get full episodes of our flagship show, WNET, going all the way back to the 90s. You get this WNET Talk before it gets uploaded as a podcast at the end of the week. And you get programs like WNET After Dark with the Great Fishniz, where he's bringing you high adrenaline tracks from his collection of hard rock and heavy metal, and WJAZ with the Jazz Man. Come on, man. You can swing, lay back with that cat. How could you possibly have a better time than that? But right now, you are listening to WNET Talk wherever you're listening to it. Maybe YouTube, maybe Spotify. We're talking about unlikely songs that were hits. And I got one right now that really sucked when it came. It really pissed me off when it came out. I'm not going to play. Man, this song, I think this song sucks so bad. But for years, for a decade now, for more than a decade, I've wondered what in the hell prompted the success of this song. Why did this happen? And this gave me an excuse to go looking into how the fuck did this song come about? And I'm talking about "What Does the Fox Say" by Ylvis, Ylvis. I don't know how to look at that and not think Elvis, but it's Ylvis. They're a Norwegian comedy duo. This dumbass song has over a billion YouTube views with a B, and when it was out, it was so annoying. I wanted to blow up any server that hosted it so that it would go away forever. I wanted to blow up any computer on Earth that had this goddamn song on its hard drive. In October of 2013, "What Does the Fox Say" peaked at number 6 on the Billboard Hot 100. Number frickin' 6. How were we so desperate for entertainment or pop music in October 2013 that we resorted to this thing? I keep calling it, what does the Fox say? The proper title is The Fox. And then in parentheses, what does the Fox say? I'm pretty sure they put the parentheses there because that's what everybody's going to call this abomination. So The Fox by Ylvis. The story is Ylvis, the duo, had a talk show in Norway, and they produced this song and video to promote season 3 of that talk show. It was supposed to be an anti-hit, basically a song that was so absurd and ridiculous that it would never get airplay or gain any kind of popularity. The idea is you make a song so bad that when people hear it, they want to turn it off. I mean, can you feel now why I would hate this song so much? I feel like there needs to be a psych exam for the people who loved it, who couldn't get enough of it. I'm tangenting. I shouldn't do that. But this dumbass recording is the highest ranking song by a Norwegian artist since Take On Me by A-ha. What a worthy freaking successor. And then, look, don't get me wrong. Take On Me by A-ha lyrically is not a masterpiece. If I were to just read verse 1 of Take On Me to you in a conversational tone, you would realize quickly that the song you've been listening to for decades, and maybe you love it, maybe you don't, but you would start to realize quickly that Take On Me is some hot nonsense when you just read it. There's nothing poetic about it. It's like they just put placeholder lyrics in and then they never went back and changed them. So I'm not saying that Take On Me is like the most beautiful story ever told in a song. But when you listen to, especially the acoustic version that became kind of a viral hit a few years back, you realize it is a very beautiful song. It is a great, you know, piece of pop music. And so the fact that you've got that and then The Fox on two sides of the Norwegian scale that hit in America is baffling. But anyway, this song featured kind of typical 2010s era pop production. The verses are preschool type descriptions of sounds that different animals make. So you've got the vocalist saying stupid shit like dog goes woof, cat goes meow, cow goes moo. There's a point where he says fish goes blub or something. It's like that was the only part of the song I actually thought was kind of cute. But other than that, in the choruses, they build up to these choruses and they ask, what does the fox say? And then, you know, they just speculate about the sound that a fox makes with the dumbest sounding shit ever recorded. And you have to hear it to understand my fury at this song being played repeatedly 12 years ago. It just made me want to shove a spike into my ears so I didn't have to hear it anymore. And yeah, I might not hear anything else either, but it would be worth it if part of the shit I was never hearing again was Ylvis with this nonsense. Apparently, the duo worked with the Stargate production company in New York City, and Ylvis had this idea where they were going to come to America to make a hit song, but they were going to go back to their talk show, kind of like with their tail between their legs, confessing to the audience that, you know, they blew their shot at stardom on a song about what the fox says. So there's your bit. And the fucking irony was this song blew up and it went top 10 on Billboard. And they wound up going on Ellen, Late Night with Jimmy Fallon, The Today Show, and promoting this stupid viral hit on all those platforms. And then they went back to Norway and their talk show as one of the biggest acts on the planet. So if you've ever wondered, is there a God, you can look at songs like this and realize the answer is probably not. Anyway, let's shift gears now. Let's talk about another one that kind of pissed me off when it was out. You know, when this thing debuted and it was new, I was baffled by it as well. And I still kind of am. It doesn't piss me off as much as that last one. But I'll put it this way. Researching it brought up some feelings about this artist and what he did with this album that just kind of made me go, no, you shouldn't have been a hit. You shouldn't have been successful. And I'm talking about Baz Luhrmann, who, if you don't know who that is, he is a film director from Australia. He made a movie called Strictly Ballroom, and then he had a global smash with Romeo and Juliet with Leonardo DiCaprio and Claire Danes in 96. So Baz Luhrmann is somebody who was very visible in the 90s, and he had included a cover of the song Everybody's Free to Feel Good, which was originally by Rosala, on the soundtrack to Romeo and Juliet. So you're with me to this point. He's directed these films. There's a version of the song Everybody's Free to Feel Good on that soundtrack. And that song, by the way, had been an international hit in 91. And this is where it gets kind of convoluted. So he's remixing the remake of that song that he did for the Romeo and Juliet soundtrack because he's putting out a compilation album under his own name in 97. And this collection is called Something for Everybody. And it's just music from his films and this opera that he had done. And so apparently he's working on that remix with two other musicians. And they get this email forward that is going around at that time of this hypothetical graduation commencement speech. And it's credited to author Kurt Vonnegut. And if you're too young to remember what in the hell these chain emails were like, they were basically just the cut and paste viral stupid shit that your parents put on Facebook all day long. And they would just forward them directly to your email. So you'd open it up and it would read exactly like the stupid Facebook posts do today. And it would tell you to copy that to everybody you know. And there was this thing of, it was very well written. And it was a cool, hypothetical graduation speech that purportedly Kurt Vonnegut had given at MIT. And they really like it. And they decide, this is what the track needs. They just have this weird burst of inspiration. We're going to incorporate this email forwarded graduation speech into this remix track of Everybody's Free to Feel Good, which has nothing to do with the original song, but we're going to put it in there anyway. So they try and reach out to Kurt Vonnegut to get permission, but as they're researching how to do that, they come across the fact that Kurt Vonnegut had nothing to do with this graduation speech. It was not written by him. He, in fact, had not even spoken at MIT in the year that it alleged he had given this speech. And it was actually a column from the Chicago Tribune by writer Mary Schmick. I hope I'm saying that right. S-C-H-M-I-C-H. The best I can figure how you would say that name is Schmick. So if I'm saying that wrong, we're just going to pretend I'm saying it right. They got her approval. They reached out to her. They said, here's what we want to do. She was like, absolutely. You can use my speech in your song. And so Baz Luhrmann had voiceover actor Lee Perry narrate the speech on the track. Perry would go on to be in the Happy Feet movies and even appear in one of the Mad Max films, Furiosa, last year. Now, I was 19 at the time this became a hit, and it was bizarre to me that this track with an electronic dance beat and stiff, emotionless narration by this dude, Lee Perry, who clearly sounded like he was our parents' generation or older, could captivate so many young people. I was blown away. I was like, why is this weird song with music that sounds like it's from a commercial for like Old Navy or something, with this old guy speaking over it, is such a hit? Like, where's this coming from? Why do we want this? And all I knew was I sure didn't. I think my theory is that the kids who were 18 that year just liked hearing their graduating class mentioned in a song, you know, didn't take much to, this is before you could become a YouTube celebrity. So I guess a lot of us were just like, oh, hey, we feel seen right now. I don't know. But I mean, the commencement speech and thus the song itself, they were full of good advice. But the original author said in the title to the piece that it was probably wasted on the young. And that's true. I mean, many of the people who liked this song when it came out were kids at the time. And in researching this, I've seen where several of them admit they wish they'd followed more of the advice found in the song, specifically wearing sunscreen more, because, you know, you can't go back and undo that. This song would be parodied to death. Chris Rock probably did the most famous one, No Sex in the Champagne Room, where he is giving people a lot of advice on what to expect and not to expect when you go to a strip club and other things in life that, might have covered a different category of life experiences than the Baz Luhrmann song did. Also, one that I kind of like was on the King of the Hill soundtrack in 1999. It was called Mo Against the Grain, and you've got Hank Hill dispensing some pretty good advice about being a suburban, you know, blue collar type, you know, just living your life to the fullest. So anyway, there you go. That everybody's free to wear sunscreen was the one I was talking about at the beginning of this that I kind of wanted to do a more in-depth piece on. I wanted to do like a full episode on just how the hell the planets aligned to make this thing hit when it did. And why was this spoken word track such a thing? I hope I got it out of my system here. And this thing pissed me off when it came out, mostly because I thought Baz Luhrmann was just one of the most pretentious sons of bitches on the planet. Number one, I didn't like the remake of Romeo and Juliet that he cast Leonardo DiCaprio in. And then there's like guns and Hawaiian shirts and rap music. And I'm like, what the fuck? How is this Romeo and Juliet? And I don't think that movie aged super well. And I don't mean like, you know, there's cancelable shit in it. I just mean you look at it today and you're like, wow, this is 1996 in a movie and it doesn't feel like the timeless story that it should. Number two, I remember picking this CD up in a music store. And I don't mean picking it up in the sense of like buying it because fuck no, I wasn't going to do that. But I remember physically holding it in my hand and looking at the track list on the back of it and seeing shit like Nut Bod, parentheses, Houseboats of Kashmir Mix, or Os Cuendos de Yaya, or the final track on it is Jupiter, parentheses, Edit. Period, bracket, From the Planets, close bracket. That's the name of a track on the fucking CD. Why? Why, Baz? What the fuck are you? Go away with this nonsense. Let's go back to Mary Schmick and her very good advice. We don't need you to deliver it to us. She did a fine job, as did the Chicago Tribune. You're listening to WNUT Talk. We will be right back after these messages. Please don't go anywhere.
Hey, what do we got here? The ghost with the most. I mean, I can't say my name. You know, it's the B word and everything. But hey, I just want to say you're listening to WNUT. Hey, we really like it down here in the afterlife. You know what I'm saying? Oh, my God. Them guys are so funny. Anyway, listen. Hey, I got to go, man. I just want to stop by and say, hey, you're listening to WNUT. So keep it up.
Full episodes at 6, noon, and 8. The best music mix all day. WNUT.
We're back on WNUT Talk, talking about unlikely songs that were major successes, either on the Billboard album charts or on MTV, or, you know, I don't know, selling a bunch of records or just winding up somewhere that you couldn't escape them. I got three more that I had put aside and said, you know, hey, I'll figure out how many need to go into this thing as I'm getting there. And I wound up actually talking about some of these longer than I thought I would. One of these is a Christmas song we will save for another day. You know, I think I'll do my favorite right now. And that is a song called Rappin' Duke by Sean Brown. I will save the other, the Christmas song and the other non-Christmas song for another day. We'll talk about something like this again, I'm sure. Because this is kind of a fun one. I've enjoyed doing this. I hope it is translating well. I hope it is turning out to be as fun to listen to as it has been for me to do this. But Rappin' Duke, if you don't know anything about Rappin' Duke, oh my God. I'm going to take you back to a time in hip-hop when the genre was new and people were trying such innovative things and shit was just... There wasn't a formula, man. You could hit with just the most bizarre shit back in the day in the hip-hop world. Ask the Beastie Boys. I mean, God, some of the stuff that they threw at the wall and actually made stick. But this track, if you don't know Rappin' Duke, I don't know that you're ready. You might not be. Sean Brown was a guy who moved to LA in the early 80s with a vision statement. He had written out one page of all the goals that he was going to achieve on his quest to get into comedy. He was like, you know, by this time I want to have an apartment, and by this time I want to be, you know, playing shows, and by this thing he kind of had his plan. So he goes to LA. He starts performing at open mic nights. He's got a few lines of a John Wayne impression that just killed. I mean, audiences were rolling on the floor when he would do this John Wayne bit. And he had this great impersonation that he had kind of cultivated. We started when he and his brother were kids. His older brother, Greg, would do this John Wayne impression. And so Sean sees Greg do that and he copies it. He's like, you know, I'm going to copy my older brother. My older brother's the cool one. He's doing the cool things. I want to be cool too. So he starts doing this John Wayne impression. And boy, would he wind up taking that thing to heights that his brother had not imagined. So he gets on stage and starts just making audiences fall out of their chairs with this John Wayne impression. And he starts to watch the audience reaction and goes, you know, I kind of think I have something here, but I don't really know what to do with it. But rap music at that time is starting to get really big. This is like 1983, 1984. And so he decides at some point, I'm going to take this John Wayne bit that I'm doing on stage, and I'm going to turn it into a rap song, a John Wayne rap song, as if Wayne is rapping. And so he kind of starts coming up with some more material, and he starts putting some verses down that John Wayne would be saying. And he tries it out at a club called Simply Blues at Sunset and Vine in LA. And it was getting audience reactions that were so raucous and so, like, people were laughing so hard at this stuff that they were missing great key lines that were coming, you know, right after the shit that had them in stitches. So he's going, okay, I'm delivering funny shit. And then the people are laughing so loud, they're missing the even funnier shit that comes behind it. What do I do? So he breaks it up by putting a couple of lines of this John Wayne character saying, da ha, da ha, which was kind of a takeoff of John Wayne's laugh. Just the way that Wayne would punctuate something that he had said that either tickled him or whatever the case was. So anyway, he adds that in to kind of pace the rap and give the audience time to catch up before he delivers, you know, the kind of the next part of the rap. And so at some point while he's developing all this, he's of course been making recordings of this stuff. He's been recording some of his sets. He loses his day job that he's been working while he's, you know, playing the clubs in the evening. So he moves back to Sacramento and he lives with his brother Greg during that time. And a couple weeks later, a guy named H.B. Barnum calls him from L.A. H.B. Barnum was a child actor who had stayed in entertainment and wound up producing and arranging records by that time. So he had gotten a copy of the Rappin' Duke tape from somebody, and he decided he wanted to put out a 12-inch. So he calls Sean and he says, listen, you got to come back to L.A. We've got to cut this record. I want to put a 12-inch out as quickly as we can. And so Sean Brown does that. He moves back to L.A. and he records this now full version. I think the 12-inch version was longer than 6 minutes. And he puts Rappin' Duke down officially on record with Barnum producing. And now you also kind of have to think at this time, there's a lot of novelty records that are kind of getting a lot of airplay and attention around 1983 through 85-ish when this story is taking place. In 83, Rodney Dangerfield put out a song called Rappin' Rodney. He kind of just played. This was just Rodney's take on hip-hop in general. It was like, here's this novelty music that's getting big. He probably didn't think it would be around very long. And Rodney Dangerfield put his spin on it and recorded Rappin' Rodney. Then you got in 84 something called Rap Master Ronnie comes out, where somebody is impersonating Ronald Reagan. Kind of, I think the gag was he was reaching out during his campaign to appeal to his urban audience, and so he's doing it through a rap song. It's obviously not really Ronald Reagan, it's somebody impersonating him, but it's funny as hell. So that happened in 84. You got the Super Bowl Shuffle coming along the next year in 85. So there's a lot of these types of things, these sort of novelty rap records that are hitting, and Rappin' Duke by Sean Brown comes along right in the sweet spot. And the way that Sean tells it is that the record label basically begged a station to play it. They basically weren't getting any support. And so they wound up kind of talking XHRM in San Diego into playing it just one time. Just play it one time, see what the response is like. And what they found was every time they ran that song, the phones would light up and listeners would respond to what they had just heard. And they would ask for it again. And then the next time they'd play it again, the same thing would happen. So that was fine in California, but it didn't really catch on from there. So what Brown had to do was head across the country and go down south and hit markets like Texas and Louisiana and Mississippi, and he had to basically just work the record there, kind of work his way up the East Coast through the Carolinas and Virginia, and basically go to New York and kind of oversee this record becoming a hit, promote it by doing shows, promote it, you know, at stations doing interviews and real publicity for this single, which eventually did get expanded into a Rappin' Duke album. Either way, it worked. I remember hearing it as a kid. I remember loving it. I thought it was the funniest thing on the planet. I didn't even know who John Wayne was. I just thought it was a funny accent with a lot of funny lines. The thing was hilarious to me. And I also knew that every time I quoted the Daha part to my grandmother, she hated it. She was like, oh no, that thing. And so I would drive her crazy by singing Daha at her. So yeah, Rappin' Duke was huge. And wouldn't you know it, about 10 years later, Notorious B.I.G. on his album Ready to Die, he had a song called Juicy, which referenced the song. Biggie rapped in that song, "Remember Rappin' Duke, Daha, Daha. You never thought that hip-hop would take it this far." Which is a pretty awesome way for Biggie to tip the hat to somebody who came before him, and also somebody who made a big impact in kind of a limited time in a fledgling industry that went on to be a giant in music that giants like Biggie, no pun intended, made their own timeless contributions to. And so today, Sean Brown, the Rappin' Duke himself, does outreach and education for kids through music and puppetry and storytelling through a bunch of different companies like Role Model Professional Development and the Super Fun Show, live stage show that he does. There's also a YouTube channel for that. So Sean Brown has a wonderful career, and he now gives back in a very positive way. And the guy went on to be just basically a treasure to society. Yeah, well, he already was, because, I mean, Rappin' Duke, come on. Like I said, it's probably my favorite one on this list. There's probably a runner-up or two. Rappin' Duke is... If you listen to the Live 365 stream of WNUT, either on the app or on live365.com, we do run Rappin' Duke. You know, it's part of the mix of songs that we select from every day when we play our music mix on there. So you'll hear that on there. You'll also hear some of these other ones, but my God, you'll never hear What Does the Fox Say? Or Everybody's Free to Wear Sunscreen. Because Baz Luhrmann is free to suck it. This has been WNUT Talk with the unlikeliest songs to ever, you know, hit on the charts or to light up your life in some way or some fashion. You can listen to WNUT anytime you want to on the Live 365 app, which is free, or live365.com. Just search us on either one of those. We come right up. You can listen to us 24 hours a day. With full episodes of shows and a great music mix. Oh my God. You'll also hear life-changing topics discussed by me and the great Vishniz. And let me tell you, if you want any of these programs on demand at your fingertips, just go to our YouTube channel, at The Real WNUT. On YouTube, you can, you know, pull up any of these programs you want to and listen to them at your leisure. Nothing would make me happier, I promise. We're going to keep adding to that stack of great programming. Join us again right here on WNUT in the future for more WNUT Talk. We will see you next time.